Took a tree kick down the canyon on the tee shot of hole 9. No one finer as a whiner than this grumbling guest of mine on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I track down one of the hardest people in disc golf to track down because he's got his fingers in so many pots, Nate Sexton. Nate, what you thinking about?
Oh, man. Hello. Thanks for having me. What am I thinking about? Fingers in many pots. It's not sanitary, I don't think, but I'm happy to be doing it.
I guess it depends on what you're doing between them. Like, are you the person that all the truck stop bathrooms say employees must wash hands for 30 seconds?
That's why, like, I was doing a lot of 28 seconds, and they had to kind of lay down the law eventually. Now, I don't know. I mean, what I'm really thinking about, I'm excited to play this Idlewild course. I'll be honest with you. I've never played it. Pretty high on my bucket list.
That seems kind of surprising, given that you have consistently been on tour, and it is definitely a counterclockwise spin course.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. It's more about the schedule of Europe.
Okay.
It was always, like, right before or right after. And being a West Coast guy, I would fly home from Europe, and then I never really felt the motivation or the need to then jump straight back out on the road. And then it became kind of this joke where I saw some people online like, I think he's scared to play Idlewild. And then I just leaned into that and went, yeah, I'm too scared. I'm never coming. I'm just way too scared. So then for a while there, I wasn't going because I was quote unquote scared. But now I'm happy to get a chance.
Sure. And What's your first impression so far?
I haven't seen the course.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You've been in town for a day and a half and haven't seen
it? No, well, I got here yesterday. I was supposed to come a day earlier, but a flight got delayed. So plans, I didn't get to do the Jomez practice round, so today will be my first look.
Ooh. Does that imply that it'll be a surprise to people when you show up on commentary?
I guess people might be surprised. I don't know if they pay that much attention. Probably, certainly some of them do. but yeah, they might be surprised. I don't know. Hopefully it's a good surprise.
Definitely. So commentary is one of the things I most wanted to talk about with you, because the Jomez branding was like one of the best things for your career. And then you also have been able to do live coverage commentary for DGN.
Yeah, I invented commentary.
That's a fact.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a cool thing for me. Obviously, no, I did not invent it at all. I do like to think that I had some hand in sculpting the tone of disc golf commentary.
Like in what way?
Like how formal or informal maybe it is. Informal, I guess I should say. Obviously, some people are going to joke around more than others. You know, I try to kind of toe that line. And I feel like I see that style replicated across a lot of channels. And I don't know if that's, you know, I would like to take some small amount of credit. I don't know that that's true, but I do like to think that that might be true, that some of like the overarching voice of disc golf, like just the delivery, the style, the feeling of disc golf commentary, I like to think I had some hand in driving that to a place that maybe includes a little bit more jovial stuff than your typical sports broadcast. And, you know, I don't think a lot more is needed, but I do like a little bit. I think it's kind of fun to poke fun at it a little bit, because at the end of the day, you know, it is serious and we're on the inside of the bubble and, you know, disc golf is a big money thing. I still just am constantly struck by the fact that I'm like moving around the country and moving around the world and just like spinning frisbees in the woods. And, you know, it's like simultaneously like the most important thing in my life and like the least important thing on the planet, you know? So it's just a weird juxtaposition.
For sure. And I have listened to a lot of sports commentary, most often baseball, and the ones who stick in my brain are the ones who are able to inform and entertain.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Since you've been doing this for several years now, I'm very interested in who your favorite players to cover. Not necessarily people who win all the time, but people who have an interesting shot selection or someone who when you see they're going to be on your next day card, you kind of get a little excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably will come as fairly obvious to a lot of people, but the first name that comes into my head is Simon Lazat, just because of the shot selection, because of the kind of happy-go-lucky attitude, and just sort of the, if he's playing great, that's amazing, and if he's playing bad, then it's also going to be amazing because he's going to try something nutty, you know. So that's a fun thing to look forward to. He's always entertaining, no matter if he's shooting 990 or 1090. It's fun to watch Simon Lazat play. It's fun to play in his group, fun to be around him, and just see what else he's going to do. So he would probably be the first person that comes to mind for me. But other than that, I enjoy new guys for sure. Like going to Europe, and we got to do European Open this year on Jomez, and it's like I hadn't been to Europe in 4 years thanks to COVID. So every year we go there, you know, there's like 20 new Finns that you never even heard a breath of their name before. Like absolutely no recognition of ever hearing of this guy. And then you'll see him and be like, I mean, this guy's incredible. Like yeah. These people are, they're throwing huge 500 foot shots inbounds, making these 50 footers, like just nasty players. So that's fun too, to just be sort of surprised and go, I don't know anything about this guy's skill set. And then to see like, wow, like that was pretty impressive. You know, hole two, he just hit the basket or something, you know, just amazing stuff.
Sure. At least in the U.S., you'll hear another touring player say like, yo, this guy just beat me in a B tier.
Uh-huh.
Watch out for him in 2 years
yes.
or something.
Yes.
But there's not that same window into the development in say, Finland or
yes.
Sweden.
Yes. And they just have so many kids playing there. We've been saying that for, you know, 10 years now where we're like, man, those Finns are going to be good. And, you know, we're seeing that start to happen more and more. But there's just so many little short courses in Finland that are just so conducive to like an 8-year-old having a good time and playing and just spending their endless summer, you know, where it's light till late. You know, I was seeing like 10-year-olds playing at like 9 p.m., 10 p.m., like out there right next to their apartment. You know, there's like a little course and they're just out there throwing shots. So it's no small wonder that they're really skilled.
I really appreciate that you can see the utility of those courses, since most often the ones that we are thinking about or playing are big, nasty, 10,000-foot courses.
Yes, like basically useless to the regular disc golf.
Right, 355 days a year, nobody really should be playing the back tees.
yeah, even though, you know, that's fun. Like, I don't have any problem with people doing that and just playing 20 over par, whatever. That's cool. If you're enjoying it, do it. But yeah, as far as confidence building and you know, skill building, it's probably asking you to do some things that you're not capable of for most players, even for me a lot of times. I'm coming to these courses and going, hey, stop asking me to do that. I'm not capable of that.
Well, there's another par, maybe a bogey.
Yeah.
So thinking about courses that you have played, watched, talked about, what are some of the hardest to commentate on and why?
Hard to commentate on. I'm not sure I've thought of a course in that way before. And I'm not sure I make much of a differentiation between like how hard it is to commentate. Maybe a course like, I guess what I would say is a course like Winthrop or like Eureka on a really windy day,
mm-hmm.
that's hard because you do have to, you know, have that empathy for like, you're going to see like a 10, you know, and the great players and kind of guiding the fans through like a uncomfortable and frustrating moments for guys maybe that are like your friends. I guess that would maybe be where my mind goes if I'm thinking what's difficult. It's just kind of having to be like, wow, this is, you know, really going to end the tournament for them. And just sort of feeling some of those emotions as you're seeing somebody, you know, throw their third straight drive out of bounds on hole 17 at USDGC in the last round, that kind of stuff. So just the brutal stuff, I guess, would be what I would say is the hardest. Not that it, and hard is almost too strong a word. Like it's emotional and it's like intense, but it's not like I dread it or anything, you know? So I'm still happy to do those commentaries, but yeah, that's the closest it gets to being hard, I would say, is when it's going to be some course that's just unforgiving and there's just so many penalties happening and snowballing into double digit type scores.
Yeah. When you can hardly keep track of it in real time. Yes. When three guys might be doing that.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. And you can just see the life draining out of these guys as the next one, the third one goes OB, and you know, we've all been there, and you're just kind of like, there's a heat in my cheeks the heat of embarrassment that I don't feel that feeling too often. And it's one of my least favorite feelings of all the feelings I've tried. Just the super hot face. I'm like, yeah, there's 100 people here and or more watching, and I'm just like imploding and I can't get inbounds from 300 feet, and there goes the tournament.
In that situation, the only thing I can think of you saying is, dang it. Is there ever a temptation to let loose a little more?
Not in a foul way, but but in a empathetic and like just trying to set the scene for, you know, how much that's probably hurting somebody. Oh, you're talking about me personally.
Oh, sure.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant in commentary. No, I let that go all the time, but not under my breath. Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm not tempted to let other people hear me swear, but I certainly will inwardly at myself or under my breath. But I'm not the type to bellow that out.
That of everything I know about you. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it a challenge? So not just in terms of scoring, but when you see a player just losing their mind on the course,
mm-hmm.
how do you play that in commentary? Like, is that something that the Jomez guys will give a heads up to you and try to cut away from it? Or are they leaving it in cynically for views, or mm-hmm. because that is part of the narrative of the round? That is a real person doing real things.
Yeah, I think it walks a middle ground between those two extremes. They're certainly not afraid of a little drama, and I think the fans like to see that kind mm-hmm. of thing, like a real moment, and you know, but that they're gonna like bleep, you know, over foul language, and they're not gonna like just hover, like just linger on a guy who's like smashing a chair, you know, but they'll show a little bit of that. So where we can kind of go, wow, you know, look at, he's kind of come undone here in this moment or whatever. And I don't have any problem with that. I think, you know, you're in the public eye. You're out here at these tournaments. Like you don't really deserve a safe place to hide, in my opinion, to go smash your chair. Like you're out, you're here, you signed up, like, that's, and you're on a filmed card, and if that's how you want to act, then I don't feel any sympathy for somebody who's like, why would you show that? It's like, dude, don't do it if you don't want people to see it. So I don't think they like go to like a TMZ like bad level of like, you know, paparazzi like zooming in on the mistakes and really highlighting a guy. But I think that there is some journalistic responsibility to kind of show a little bit of like, wow, look how frustrated he was.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jeremy Colling, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I 3D print board game components.
I'm James Conrad, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm taking a really long run up.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish. So, Nate, kind of going back to that last point about the frustration that is shown on the course by the media companies, I think something that fans of disc golf might not appreciate is how, like, on an island pro players are in terms of things like public relations training or like being able to cultivate an image that isn't just like the social media influencer playbook. there are some players who have gotten demonstrably better at, say, public speaking in press conferences, or just like how they'll answer post-round questions or something. Do you think that is that a frontier that the Disc Golf Pro Tour might try to cross into, or could?
Could, certainly. I also think some of the onus there just falls on the player, and that's kind of a personal choice, how much resources and time you want to put into something like that, or how much natural aptitude you have for speaking or whatever it is. Some people are better than others. And if you're going to be in a position where you want to highlight that part of yourself, then it might serve you well to invest some money and some time, perhaps in some kind of training, if that's something you needed. Because I think that can pay big dividends to be able to show your personality in a way that is palatable to people and isn't distracting. Like if your communication style is on the face of it distracting, then it's hard for anyone to like make a connection with you. So I think there's certainly something to be gained from that. And I think the Pro Tour as a whole would benefit there, but I don't think as much as the player. So I guess I don't feel like the onus is on the tour to like have some kind of like media camp. It would be a nice thing for them to do, and I could see them doing it, having some optional little symposium or whatever for players to go and learn from some expert on PR. But I think the person that gains the party that gains more is the athlete. So I think there's maybe more incentive there for an athlete to figure shore that up about themselves on their own.
Sure. This is something I've been kind of interested in for a while, because we as players are operating in a very symbiotic relationship with the Pro Tour, where yes, we are both the product that they are promoting, but also in a lot of ways we are their, we're shopping at their store as well.
Yeah.
By making the choice to go to these events, and you know, we're kind of relying on the Pro Tour to make good choices for the pro game.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we get some opportunity to put our input in on those. I think they're pretty good at sort of soliciting our thoughts. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's certainly symbiotic. And when either side has some positive change happen, it certainly is felt on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Nate, this is the first time you've been to Idlewild, and you've kind of been decreasing your touring schedule in large part because of family obligations, which is great. Do you ever get the little want to go try to do the full tour again and, you know, compete for Pro Tour championship points?
No, but that isn't because it wasn't great fun. I would say I feel the sort of the sobering truth of my place in the sport and my age, whether that's right or wrong. I don't feel like a full-time tour would yield a win. I don't think, in my heart of hearts, you know?
When you say a win, you mean?
A tournament win, an elite series win.
Any elite series win at this point.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, you never know. I think I'm not playing nearly at the highest level of my career lately, and that makes sense because I'm not practicing like I once did, just because life is happening and, you know, there's lots of things on my plate. But also, I tend to feel like practicing was a lot easier when I felt like I might win pretty soon. You know, it was like the motivation was like, oh, sweet, like this is great. And now I'm in this place where I certainly wouldn't complain. I don't mean to sound like I'm complaining. I've had an incredible ride, and I truly feel I'm one of the luckiest people I've ever met in terms of my career, like how it just materialized in front of me and became quite lucrative and was just like the thing that I wanted to do while I was skipping college classes anyway, like somehow became a career for me, which is incredible and crazy. But I do definitely feel less interested in like traveling to every last tournament to get like 35th. Like it's just sort of it's more of toily now, where I'm just kind of, okay, yeah, I want to experience new places. I want to do the Jomez. I want to play great golf, and I know I can play better than I have been playing lately. But as far as the actual reality of doing like a full tour, it doesn't really cross my mind, because I couldn't stomach being away from my family that long. It isn't even a choice. There's no possible way that I could just be like, handle it, Brie. Like, my wife works so much, my daughter in school now. It just isn't possible. So I don't even really think about it in a serious way. But I also think even if it was like, okay, we're going to homeschool her, Brie's quitting her job, I just don't think I would enjoy it without the specter of like, I could win the next one, you know, where it's like that was really a lot of what motivated me.
Yeah, sure. So now you're designing your schedule based on like the ones that you really want to go to, or the ones that like have decent space between others and you can fly into and out of easily?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a big dance of schedules and you know, like my mom is up at my house today, you know, because now it's summer, so my daughter doesn't have somewhere to be in the day. So it's a lot of moving parts. Somebody for childcare, making sure that it's not like a back-to-back flight thing where I come home and leave again in 2 days. Also my own desires of where I want to play, but like I was signed up for Ledgestone. I like playing Ledgestone, but then it just felt, when I looked at the reality of when we were getting back from Europe, it just felt too fast a turnaround for me to then be right back out on a plane and out at a tournament again. So then I switched for this one to give myself a little more time before my next event. But yeah, so it's a balancing act for sure, but I try to play as much as I can, on the Elite Series, and that might amount to, I think, maybe close to half of the tournaments these days, where I'm probably getting to like 13 tournaments a year, maybe. And there's maybe twice that number of like actual Elite Series and majors on the schedule.
Yeah, sure. And you're kind of prioritizing majors when you can?
Yeah, sure. Sure. And as long as it's not Champions Cup, not interested.
I'm very interested in that, because like... I think I used to just like wholesale reject the idea of going to certain tournaments because I wouldn't like it or something.
Uh-huh.
But as I've gotten older, it's like I've got to be able to play a lot of different styles. But Jackson is one of my favorite courses. And you and I think, approach the game in a pretty similar, like relatively conservative,
yeah,
play to your strengths type way.
Yeah.
What is it about Jackson or that event that you object to?
Well, let's get one thing straight. If I could practice Jackson every day, I would. That's a fun course. Do I want to compete there? No, I've been burned too many times. It's just not, that course does not appreciate my strengths. So it's like, I can hit gaps, but I don't throw straight like the fish does. I don't throw a shot that goes 400 feet and lands like a little feather on the ground and stays where it is. I only throw hyzers that skip in the woods, and then I can get my 400 feet down the fairway, but I'm just constantly 10 feet in the rough, and the forehand roller escape counter is getting into the 6, 7, 8 per round generally. And then I'll like fight real hard, shoot a 5 under and be like, that was pretty great. And I look at the scores and be like, everyone's 11 under. And it's just that's just how that course has always gone for me, where it's been. And that was when I was playing good golf. I would be like, I'd be struggling. And now the field there is like such a good assembly of players, you know, it's qualification only. It's the best players. And it's just not the course for a forehand dominant hyzer throwing guy, I think. And so it's not that I'm like afraid to play bad, but it's that I have had a miserable time when I've gone there, because I expect so much more of myself. I'm getting beat by players that I feel like I should be beating, though I shouldn't on that style, because that's just not what I've developed and that's not what my game is.
Sure. And do you feel, are there other courses that make you feel that same way, that players you think you're demonstrably better than are beating you?
Yeah, that happens for sure, but nowhere as consistently or as obviously as W.R. Jackson in my experience so far.
Is it easier to reckon with that on distance heavy courses versus that like fairway driver in the woods?
Well, yeah, the distance heavy courses, I guess I never really feel like I ought to be doing that well, you know? So it's like, but when the holes are in range, you kind of feel like, man, like I, you know, in a perfect world, I should be birdieing these. I should be able to stay in the fairway. But yeah, I guess it is more difficult because on the distance courses, I sort of have already, you know, accepted the fact that it's going to be hard for me.
15th.
It's going to be hard for me to keep up out here because disc golf is, at the end of the day, is a game of just creating opportunities for yourself. And I'm a pretty firm believer that like C1 in regulation is like the statistic that wins the tournament, you know? So it's like, if you can't achieve that, then you have to be some kind of crazy hero miracle worker everywhere else on the course to just be throwing shots in. Cause if Ricky Wysocki is in C1 twice as often as you, you aren't beating this guy, you know, like it's just not, it can't be done.
Yeah, for sure. At this point in your career, are you trying to find a way to not have your forehand skip into the woods? Like what are you doing with your game in your perhaps limited practice time?
Sure. I mean, I dream about it. Yeah, but it's hard. It's like I'm at a place, and I have been for a long time, where I'll be like, all my practice rounds, I'll be like, yeah, I think I'm going to throw the backhand leopard, and then the tournament comes, like, no, I'm just gonna throw the forehand. The gap looks tiny today, and that's just how my mental is. Like, it's just always been that way. It's hard for me to hit the backhand as hard as I do in practice through a gap or with the OB around. It's just hard for me to commit to it in the way that I want to, in the way that I'm capable of in practice, but I struggle to do when the chips are down. And I tend to kind of retreat into the security blanket of the forehand that will hit the gap and make it down the fairway a bit, albeit slightly in the woods on some of these courses.
Sure. And for a long time, you were able to rely on that and still be chasing wins at every level.
Mm-hmm.
Now that that's not quite possible, and I'm going to attribute that more to the field than to you.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Where does disc golf go in the next, say, 5 years in terms of player skill and course design to counter that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think player skill is there's no real ceiling on that. There's going to be some incredible players continuing to show up and blow our minds. That's kind of how it's always been. The next guy is always unbelievable. So I expect that to continue. I kind of feel like, maybe I'm being optimistic, but I sort of feel like I feel the rubber band swinging back, and maybe the pendulum swung a little too far on the distance thing. And I sort of feel like 2 years ago in Kansas was like the peak of it, where it was like 600-foot par three with OB. And even Anthony Barella's going, this is pretty stupid, you know? So then once you start hearing that, it's like, naturally, I hope to see it swing back a bit. And I feel like we're maybe starting to feel that a little bit and bringing a little bit more technicality. But I understand the difficulty of, you know, everyone wants to see golf in the woods, sure. But then you also want to sell 2,000 tickets. And those people need to have a good time. And there needs to be a place for them to stand. And they need to be able to see the winning putt. And it's like, there's a lot of interested parties and stakeholders here that it makes sense to me why the ball golf course revolution is here in such a big way, because it's private land. You can control entry and exit. You can control whether there's somebody trying to have a picnic in the middle of the fairway who is within their rights to do so, you know, in some cases in a public park. You know, some of them are like unreservable. So I get that, and I understand the fans going, oh man, another ball golf course. But if you really start to think about the pro tours, the push and pull on the pro tour when it comes to like sell signal, ticket sales, all these different things, opportunities for vendors, whatever it is, parking, all those different things, you can understand why the pro tour isn't at the course down your street that's like got 20 parking spots and is a nasty woods course, but like it just can't be done. You know, you can't bring the big show.
Sure, no doubt. And every one of the local organizers who has made a choice to switch over to a ball golf course is making the best choice that they can for their local scene.
Yeah.
So like, it's hard to begrudge them that. It's just as a general trend, I'm kind of bored with it.
Sure. Sure. That makes sense. And I think fans feel that same way. But it's not an easy nut to crack. In terms of like, what do you do instead? You know, it's like that's the part that I try to remind people of, because it's easy enough to say, oh, why isn't it back at, you know, Delaware or whatever. You know, I haven't been there either, but that's a course that is crazy wooded, right?
Like, it's very wooded. However, I think it got cleared a little bit too much to try to accommodate mm-hmm. spectators when the NT was starting to go there.
Yeah.
And although they have plans to let some of that grow back in, those things take a lot of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there were a couple holes that didn't quite work for various reasons, whether trees came down or players just got too doggone good at playing 625 par four.
Yeah, sure. They are good at that. Yeah. And that shows you right there. There's the push and pull. There's the difficulty. You know, you take a course that was beloved and then maybe it's like trying to satisfy everyone is not easy.
Yeah, no doubt. So anyway, you had the good fortune when you were like really starting to make your stamp as a pro to have Avery Jenkins and Dave Feldberg and some of those other very established touring players in your local region beating up on you.
Yeah.
Are you that guy in Oregon at all right now?
No, I don't play. It's Scott Withers is that guy. And Chris Nelson is that guy. I haven't played but a handful of A and B tiers in the last 5 years. I would say I've played like maybe five in the last 5 years where I'm playing like a smaller tournament. It's just been hard to carve out the time. Like if I have time, it's like the priority is like getting on another plane and checking off one more pro tour to satisfy my obligations as a sponsored player and to, you know, try to live up to all that. And so no, I'm not that guy at all, though. I wouldn't mind giving it a try, though. I don't think I'm going to be beaten up on them too bad. There's some pretty good players. Like it's a different thing than had I been, playing B tiers at age 30 or 29, you know, at the kind of the peak of my powers.
Yeah, sure.
But I would like to play a little bit more locally. I have some hope that transitioning into playing some Masters tournaments will be like, sort of reinvigorating in that I will clearly have a shot to win, which will be fun because that's just kind of why I got into this whole thing anyway, was to try to, to try to win. You know, it's like sometimes I know I love disc golf, but sometimes certainly the question will cross my mind. Do I love disc golf or do I just love being good at something? You know what I mean? Like, so it's like there's certainly that's part of it. It's not just that I'm like, the flights are so beautiful. I don't care what place I get. You know, so it's like there's some part of me that's like, I guess I got here because it's fun being patted on the back and it's fun having people go, hey, we want to sponsor you. You're the man. This is you're so amazing at this. And you're like, well, I guess I'll do this tomorrow then. If everyone thinks I'm so good at it and everyone wants to see me do it, I guess I'll do it.
I think it can be both, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think it is both for me, but that, it's like, but there's certainly a mix.
That's the like fiscally sustainable thing, but the long-term emotional isn't other people telling you you're great. It is when you hit that perfect flight.
Yes.
And it's like, wow, I could do that forever.
Yes. I have both of those things for sure. Like, yeah, just kind of the fun you get when you do play like around by yourself or whatever, and you hit something perfect. That's always an awesome feeling as well.
All right, well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me, taking time out of your busy day. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And Nate, if people hated the show and want to complain about it, where can they find you?
Oh, man, on Twitter. I've never had an account. I feel like I'm so such a genius never signing up for Twitter now. It seems like it's really gone to the dogs.
Yeah, the long play was the best play there.
Yeah, I just never got into it. But no, you can find me. You can send a complaint. I field a lot of those, you know, with all the commentary. So yeah, you go ahead. Find me on Instagram. send over something. And I'll get my people on it as quickly as I can.
Smart. Do you have any Tour Series disc coming out this year?
Yeah, Sexton Firebirds quite soon, I think. It's been a long wait, but they should be pretty special this year.
Okay, hopefully just in time for Worlds.
I would think. I don't strictly know, but I could see it could be before that even. I don't know.
Okay, well, there's always a delay in this podcast getting posted.
There we go. Maybe they're already out. I hope you guys are enjoying them.
All right, Nate. Thank you so much, and we will be sure to see you out there on the road.
Sounds good.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast.